Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Power of Love Radio Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Power of Love Radio Show, sponsored by the Dede Jackson Foundation, where we shine a light on loss and grief and how it impacts our lives. We are here to provide hope, resources, and a community. That's a hard word to say sometimes. Community.
It is community.
So no one feels alone in their grief. We believe that through the power of love, that nothing is impossible with love on your side. I am TJ Jackson, and I am here with Miss Henry Hebert.
Hello, hello.
Say hi, Henry.
Hi.
And Henry, do you want to introduce our special guest?
I do. Well, we are live, so if you're listening to us right now, thanks for joining us. And this is show number 11.
Yes, yes.
And later on, we are going to be opening up to questions via Twitter. And so if you have a question about our topic, which is loss and grief, and you want to ask, then send us a tweet at DDJ Foundation.
So we're not licensed therapists, as I like to tell and remind everyone. We are just average
ordinary people.
Yeah, ordinary people.
Nothing Mr. ordinary
John
about us.
We are just ordinary people who have experienced loss and grief and believe that we can, if we share it and come together as one, it makes it easier to cope with loss and grief.
That was well said.
Thank you.
And that kind of goes right into our guest this week. Our guest this week is one of our board members, Kim yes. Wendt. We are so happy to have her here with us today. She's going to be sharing her story of loss and grief. And in 2015, Kim's mom died from liver cancer. Her mom was diagnosed 3 years before and had the will to live beyond the 7 to 8 months that the doctors had predicted. And in September of 2015, Kim's mom was in hospice and was really sick and in a lot of pain and was holding on. But the hospice nurse had a life-altering talk with Kim about letting go. And that moment changed Kim's life forever. And today, Kim is going to share this story with us. Welcome, Kim.
Thank you so much.
We're so happy to have you here with us.
Yes.
So, hello. And Terrell Jackson just walked in.
And Taj won't be here today. He has a commitment, so he cannot make it in today. But Terrell, me, Henry, and Miss Kimberly is here.
Miss yes. Kim. So, Kim, can you share with us, I'll start with your childhood. I think that's kind of where it began in terms of your mom's strength to live and really just being close to her. So you had a really close relationship with her.
I did. So I like to say normal is just a setting on the dryer. It was not a normal childhood. There was a lot of trauma, a lot of chaos. I was fortunate that I was very close to my mom, and we remained close through all those times. Probably one of the most significant things that happened, my dad actually lost his dad in high school, and I don't know that he ever dealt with that. He became a trial lawyer, had unprecedented success at an early age, and that really led...
he was a high-powered trial lawyer in St. Louis?
St. Louis, yep. And he was doing criminal defense at the time, made a lot of money, and just wasn't really equipped to handle that. And that sort of led to his demise. He got in all kinds of trouble.
A lot of money and needed a lot of power, too, is...
Absolutely, yep. He was eventually convicted of a crime he didn't technically commit, but he did go to prison for that, and he would be the first to tell you he was guilty of a lot of other things, just not that particular crime.
So was this a white-collar crime?
The actual conviction was for attempted jailbreak, but what happened was the FBI, it was kind of a setup, the FBI tape recorded him. They had a secret agent proposing that he break someone out of jail. And he was under the influence of a lot of alcohol at the time. And they offered him $3,000. So he took the $3,000 because he was desperate for money, knowing full well that he wasn't going to follow through on the crime. So he basically stole the money. But that was an undercover FBI agent. And there were helicopters surrounding our house. I opened the door to the FBI.
How old were you?
I was 8. during that time.
That must have been really scary. 8 years old. Were they coming in to raid the house?
No, it wasn't. It was more professional. It was just an average night. I think I was watching the Dukes of Hazzard on a Friday night, and I opened the door, and there was a man with a big badge, and he said, "Is your dad home?" And I said, "No," and my mom came and kind of explained what had been going on. So we went through the trial proceedings. There was a lot of media involved. I couldn't go to school for a week. And it was just sad. It was sad to see.
I think you would, when you talked to me about it, you were saying how you felt emotionally, and that, and what we've been just learning, that psychological loss can be really hurtful to a child. So at that time, you're going through, your dad is an alcoholic, and there's the emotional loss of having a dad being able to nurture you, and at the same time, your mom's undergoing a lot of stress, so she shut down at an early age. And you know, with that comes your dad's going to prison, and I think you said there's a lot of negative media where things are being said about your family all over headlines, which I think you guys can maybe relate to this.
Definitely.
And I think that oftentimes, you know, when we read the news, we're not thinking about the other people involved, children involved. We're not thinking about the spouse. You know, we're just, you know, we're gasping like, oh my God, I can't believe that person did that. But meanwhile, there's a family there. There's people with emotions. There's people struggling. And so I think that, you know, TJ and Terrell can understand probably this aspect of it. So how are you feeling as a child? Like, did you feel ashamed? Did you feel embarrassed? Did you feel scared?
All the above. My parents tried to shield us as much as possible, but there was a night where I was at my grandparents' house and they had the news on, and I don't know that they even realized it was going to be covered that evening, so I actually saw the live coverage.
What was the live coverage?
Just talking about the verdict of the trial and what his sentencing was, what was going to happen, kind of some of the details around the case. In terms of, like, being ashamed, I knew that he was my dad, and I knew that he had done something he shouldn't have. I also, at a very young age, understood that he was sick with alcoholism. But I couldn't go to school for a week. Really, all I wanted to do was be with my friends at their house because it was a normal environment. Years later, I think one of the hardest things that happened was my dad went into a full recovery. He eventually wound up getting a presidential pardon from President Clinton, put his life back together, and his legal career took off in a different area. But during those times where he was rebuilding, I was at a party in high school, and one of my best friends who knew my family had too much to drink and started talking about how my dad was an ex-con. That was probably the hardest moment because it was a moment where he was down on his knees, he was homeless. He was doing everything he could to put his life back together. Granted, she was a teenager, but things like that stick with you.
How old were you when that happened at the party?
15 or 16.
Yeah. Yeah, I can relate to something very similar. You know, when you're, as you said earlier, Henry, with our family always in the news, always in the media, I think a lot of our friends and family kind of insulate you. But sometimes there's a quote-unquote slip where whether it's alcohol or you overhear something from someone that you thought was a friend and they say something that could just really cuts deep because, A, especially when you know the person that they're talking about and you know how, you know, all the great things about that person, it just cuts you really deeply coming from someone you thought was quote-unquote on your side or on your team and knew. You know, so I can definitely, and that's happened to us, you know, mostly regarding my uncle, but similar thing where when it comes from a friend or something or someone you thought was a friend, a negative thing about someone you love and care for, it hurts.
Yeah, it really cuts to the core.
Yeah.
Because it's a betrayal.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't think, too, in our society, it's not something we're taught to how to handle situations that are... It's like your dad, something happened and he paid for it. Mm-hmm. I mean, he did his time and he then was rebuilding his life. It's like we don't have the element of, like, we want that second chance story and we wanna put it on the pedestal. Like, wow, they got a second chance at life. But yet I don't think we're always compassionate and offering people love and kindness when they're rebuilding their life. And we kind of are quick to hold people to that negative space of, well, they did that, so they're this kind of person. So we're not even then allowing them to grow out of that space
like
to have learned.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, like labels.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, it's is, and it's like that's a really difficult, that's hard. I mean, your family protecting you, but at the same time, they can't protect you from everything else in the real world.
Right.
Which is, I think, similar to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really similar because at the time, he was really investing himself in helping other alcoholics. And from a humanitarian standpoint, when people try to do good things and then there's negative things said about them, it's just frustrating.
So then during this time, you also, your mom was sick or she went into a surgery?
She, during those high school years, she actually was probably looking back in a clinical depression. She was also taking care of her two parents that were dying. She, when I was a senior in college, experienced cancer. We thought she was going to die then. They operated for 19 hours, and she wound up having a full recovery.
What kind of cancer did she have?
She had cancer in the floor of her mouth. And at the time,
wow.
She didn't have medical insurance. So,
is that because everything going on with your dad?
Yep. So we had really lost everything.
Did you lose your house, everything? So you went from being, which is also interesting, you went from having a lot of wealth and living this life to all of a sudden almost becoming homeless, and her parents had to take you in, right?
Yeah, so there were nights where my mom didn't want to ask her parents for money. She was just very prideful like that. And she told us we might be going to live to a shelter. We lost, excuse me, our home. Both cars were repossessed. And finally, she talked to my grandparents, and they bought us a small little house, and we moved in a hurry. But there were times where I didn't know where we were going to go.
Did you stay in the same neighborhood, or did you move away from the neighborhood?
We actually moved to a neighboring town because my mom thought it would be good for us to have a fresh start in a new school. Ironically,
that's hard too, because the loss of, like, when you move, the loss of a neighborhood, that can cause a lot of pain too for a whole family, especially for a child, though.
Yeah, and I had a lot of good friends. I was already kind of in a fearful state. I was excited for a fresh start, but still nervous to make new friends. Right before we went back to school, we had an incident where our dogs got in a fight with a neighbor's dogs, and she threatened to expose the story about my dad to all of the neighbors if we didn't put our two dogs to sleep. And at that point, the dogs were really my mom's comfort, her only comfort, and she was forced to put them down.
Mm. Wow.
And they were, of course, the neighbors that were sort of the pillars of the community, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow. How old are you at this point, Kim?
10.
10.
Fifth grade.
Are you understanding all this, what's going on, and how are you, what's your outlet?
I was understanding it. My mom always felt guilty to some degree because I was somewhat her confidant. So I knew more than I should have at mm-hmm. a very young age. I kind of took on a parenting role, both to my little brother, also to my mom and dad at times. And I really, I think what I did the most was I prayed. We didn't actually go to church as a family, but I learned at a really young age when we were losing our house and losing the cars and there was fighting. That was my coping mechanism, was just to ask for help and to believe that things would get better, because I didn't have any other outlet.
Mm-hmm.
And music. I loved music as a kid. I had my parents' record player set up in my closet. It was a walk-in closet, and I had all my stuffed animals, so when things got really difficult, I would just sort of retreat to my closet and play the records.
Who did you listen to?
Well, if you must know.
I want to know.
One of the first albums was the Jackson 5. One of my favorite songs was ABC, along with the Bee Gees, John Denver, and Neil Diamond. All my parents' records.
Great.
Nice.
Cool.
So then your mom, she had that surgery when you were, how old were you then?
I was actually a freshman in college.
And she lived through that cancer?
Fully recovered.
And that was scary, though, because you almost lost her then.
Yep, and at that time, I just remember praying that I went to KU, as did she, and I just wanted her to be able to see me graduate from college.
Kansas University?
Mm-hmm. And so I just said a prayer, please bring her through the surgery, let her see me graduate, and I got an additional 20 years, which I feel really thankful for. Mm.
So, and faith has definitely been a big part of your life.
Huge.
Throughout moments when you needed just strength, you felt the call to God and prayed, and you often would find that would help you through.
Absolutely.
So now, so then 17 years later,
mm-hmm.
your mom is diagnosed with liver cancer.
Correct.
So how old were you at this time?
40.
You can say around 40.
Yeah, 40. I like to admit my age on air.
Around 40.
Yeah.
So she's diagnosed with liver cancer. You're living in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor said your mom's going to have 7 to 8 months to live.
Correct.
How did you feel at this, and what did you do?
You know, it had been a long road up to that. She had a number of health problems over those 20 years. You know, it was a shock. She went in for a stomach ache, and they immediately put her in the emergency room and started running tests. And 3 days later, we were at the oncologist's office.
Wow.
And 2 days later, they wanted to put a port in to start the chemotherapy because it was that aggressive. It was stage four. So there was shock. Once she began treatment, there was grief, sadness, acceptance. And then we really made a plan. Like, how are we going to do this? And
what kind of plan? Like, what do you mean? In terms of treatment or life?
No, in terms of life. She had had so much loss in her life, primarily loss of health and loss of finances.
And I think you had mentioned she struggled with depression, too. So having that kind of depressed state of mind, being sad a lot of her life because of things that have happened to her.
Yeah, absolutely. And
so now she's coming face to face with, like, the reality of, okay, I might only have 8 months to live. So what did you then, is that, like, what do we do with these 8 months to live?
And it actually, they wound up being the happiest years of her life.
Mm.
There's a song by Tim McGraw, like, Live Like You Were Dying. And we had a long talk, like, let's make this the best 8 months of your life. So I put her in the car. We drove to Colorado to see my brother 18 hours in a car with my mom, 10 oxygen tanks, a dog, walkers, wheelchairs.
Wow.
I had a party for her. We didn't know if she was going to make it to her birthday, so we just called it a celebration of life. But we invited all of her friends from childhood, teenage years, college. Everyone came together. We did a slideshow. We just really lived each day for her and to bring her happy experiences to look forward to. And ironically, with each one of those experiences, whether it was a trip or a party, it gave her a little more of a boost to keep going.
And then you at this time took on being full-time caretaker to her?
Correct.
So what is it like? So were you living with her? Were you...
She was living with me for a while, and that was actually difficult on our relationship because she wanted to be the mom. She was in my house, but... You know, she would kind of be reminding me of turning off the lights and silly things like that.
Asking you what time you'd be home at night?
Pretty much.
You had a curfew?
Yes. And I said, you know, I don't know if this is working. Do you want to go back to your house and we'll make other arrangements? And ironically, once she got back into her house and had her independence, she flourished even more. And there was a period of time where she was okay living alone. I was covering 7 states, and then progressively...
For your job?
Mm-hmm. We needed more and more care, so I had to start orchestrating what that looked like.
So then how did you feel, though? Was that stressful to you? I mean, because you kind of also, the other aspects of your life, your personal life, probably took up a lot of your time.
I really didn't have much time to do anything besides care for her logistical, medical, spiritual needs and work.
And so that's almost like becomes like a 24/7 on your mind.
Yep.
And then she's your best friend, talking to her all the time, every day.
Yep, multiple times.
Telling her everything. And she actually lived beyond the 8 months for 3 years.
3 years.
Which is amazing. And I think her strength and her will to live, which I think 20 years prior when she had that first surgery and she almost died, she just knew that she wanted to live and lived.
But also coupled with, I think, how you took care of her and the love and the enjoyment and happiness from the trips. I think that all contributed to extend her life, too.
I think so, too. Yeah. The joy.
Yeah.
And it was a real blessing for me. Yeah. You know, people say that cancer is terrible. It is. But I feel really blessed that I got the chance to say goodbye. When you get a terminal diagnosis, that's one of the benefits is that you have that opportunity. Whereas, you know, in other cases where it's an unexpected death, you don't get that.
Do you feel some type of, I assume you really didn't experience an unexpected death. Do you feel that because you had a notice, you have a lot better closure?
Absolutely.
Now, would you feel that way if you were 20 years younger or a teenager, you think? Or do you think because you're older and more experienced in life, you knew you were a bit more mature and could handle it better and therefore close better?
I think both. You know, I think even at a young age, if you understand someone's dying, you have that chance to say goodbye. In my case, in fact, one of the therapists I worked with said, grief is so much harder when you don't get that chance. Because I fortunately didn't have regrets. I had all the opportunities to say what I wanted to say. And certainly maturity played a big part of it.
So the final months of your mom's life was a bit more challenging in terms of what you had to face. And it's definitely something that we have not talked about yet, and I hadn't even heard this before you actually brought it up and told me the story. So I'd love for you to share what ended up happening.
Sure. So a lot of times with cancer, after prolonged chemotherapy, the body weakens, and your immune system is compromised, so you start getting other illnesses, pneumonia, things like that.
So, and I've heard that you can actually die for something else and not just from the cancer.
Mostly you do. Mostly it's not the cancer. I made the decision. I had a unique job opportunity to do what I had always wanted to do, which was work in pediatric rare diseases. But I also knew that there was a chance my mom could get sicker. I went ahead and took the job.
And I think we have to explain that you actually are a pharmaceutical sales rep.
Yep.
So that's why you travel. And so working in pediatric, what is it?
I was working in orphan diseases at the time, so very rare genetic disorders.
So then that would mean you traveling to different states.
Yep. I had at the time 7 states in the Midwest.
Okay. Repping as a pharmaceutical.
Yep.
Okay.
And I went to the interview. I came back. She was hospitalized during that interview, started training, and then she was hospitalized. I think it was for pneumonia. A lot of different complications. What really wound up happening is that she had so much fluid in her. She wasn't on a diuretic. She went into congestive heart failure. They sent her home with home nursing. She went back in the hospital a week later, and they couldn't get the fluid off. So she was gasping for air. She couldn't catch her breath. And that was probably one of the hardest things to see. It's kind of like watching someone drown. So I just kept praying, you know, once they got the medication on board that she would have some relief because I knew how much she was struggling.
Was she in a lot of pain?
There was pain, but I think it was more the lack of catching her breath that was so difficult.
As you're saying that, I'm trying to catch my breath. Like, I'm like breathing, thinking about it.
And it's really hard to watch. Because you want to help someone, you want to relieve them, and she's trying and nothing's working. But fortunately, she did come out of that.
So then what ended up happening? So did she go into hospice eventually?
Yep. So what happened was they had originally put a stent in one of her liver ducts, and I kept saying, Mom, they told us the stent would only last for a year or two. We should really wind up and or go back and get that replaced. I got a call. Actually, I got 3 calls in a row. It was on Good Friday, and I was in church, so I didn't pick up the call. And when I got out, it was my mom, and at the end of the call, she had dropped the phone. So I ran right over, and she had collapsed on the floor, and I took her to the emergency room, and they had her waiting for like an hour and a half, and they said, I know something's really wrong. What happened was the stent in her liver had broke, and your liver is the purifying agent, so everything toxic was circulating through her bloodstream. She had what was called septic shock. And had we not gotten her there, she would have died at that point. They did do an emergency surgery, replaced the stent. She was in ICU for a couple weeks, and that was really the beginning of the end. And that's at the point where they talked to us that there's just nothing more they can do. They didn't want her to die in the hospital. She didn't want to die in the hospital, so we were sent home on hospice, which was a wonderful experience.
So we have to hold on a minute. Let's talk about how you were feeling through that, because that's like, there's nothing more than we can do. Did they actually say those words?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, first of all, I can't imagine them having to deliver that, and just, those are really hard words to hear, to say and to hear. So how did you feel, and what was going through your mind? Like, what was that like?
You know, I think for so long, every time we would go to the emergency room or there'd be a complication, I would think, is this it? Is this the end? And some of the procedures I watched her go through during that last hospitalization and the level of pain, you know, hearing her cry and scream. I guess when they delivered the news, I just had to accept that she was on the path of more and more suffering, and that this was the best we could do. And
that must be really hard to think about, though, the best that we can do. And
yeah, it was. I think that I was in shock, and kind of, I have the tendency just to overfunction and get through it. And, you know, my mind was going to what's next. How am I going to set this? I knew she didn't want to die in a nursing home or in the hospital, but yet I had this new job and I was traveling, so how am I going to orchestrate this kind of home hospital, if you will? It was interesting because my aunt and uncle had come up to visit her.
Did they, in terms of when they tell you this too, like, do they suggest you go see a grief therapist, or is there like some kind of, I don't know, brochure? How do you get through this? What's the steps to take, and emotionally, mentally, and, you know, in the physical kind of space?
Yeah, I was fortunate because I was working with a Christian counselor that I had known for years. She was very helpful during that time. But when anyone goes on hospice, that's definitely part of the program. So they send a chaplain in. They kind of walk through what the services are for the patient, and then also
what do they say?
Well, there's a number of different things, and they're including more and more modalities every day. But they have,
like, in Catholicism, like, it's like last rites. Like, they talk about,
get into that much detail. But they talk about the dying process. They talk about what to expect. They have a social worker. They have a massage therapist, different nurses.
I like the massage therapist.
I know.
Part.
That was my mom's favorite part. In fact, there a couple times when she canceled, I was like, can I have your spot? But the hospice programs in general are fabulous because they're all trained professionals, and all they deal with are people dying.
So then, okay, what happens then where your mom is in a lot of pain and suffering?
Yep.
And I've heard this before where, like, the pain and the person's screaming, was that your experience of it too?
Yeah.
And I have a friend that has told me that, and they still can't get, like, the pain of their mother screaming, like, out of their head. Like, sometimes it just pops in her head because it was so traumatic, and it was so hard to hear.
While they're passing?
It's kind of like during the death process, before they die. It's my friend, it was like 3 days of, like, screaming.
This was not actually while she was dying. This was when she was hospitalized, and they were trying to give her different treatments, and one of them was they stuck a huge needle into an artery, not a vein, an artery. And that's at the point where I knew, and she said to me, I can't go through any more of these things. I don't want to.
Wow.
And they sent her home on hospice, and they predicted she would live 2 to 3 days. And she lived another 3 months.
Wow, your mom's will.
We called her the tough old bird. She was like Teflon.
I love that. So then what ended up happening with one of the nurses that you had a life-altering conversation with?
So it was over the summer, and I was able to see her at least every couple days. Towards the end, they explained to me that she was holding on for my brother and I. My brother was going through some tough times, and they said, your mom doesn't want to let go because she just wants to make sure her kids are okay. And once they explained that, I saw the process. And even though my parents were divorced, my dad and my stepmother, aunts and uncles, were instrumental in kind of rallying around her at that time. And I think that felt so good to her that she didn't want to let go. She was just loving having all of her family.
She finally had the joy in her life to live.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, people say things that you normally wouldn't say that were very healing to her. So she didn't want to let go, but at the same time, her disease was progressing. And
was her body breaking down, too, at this point?
It was. And one of her biggest things was that she wanted to die with dignity. And that was a big part of keeping her at home. During that time, though, I didn't have a leave of absence available for work, so I was still trying to travel and paying for private care. I think it was close to $10,000 a month.
Oh, my God. Wow.
But luckily, we had some money saved, and those were her wishes, and I figured we've come this far.
Mm-hmm. So what else in that conversation that, because you shared with me, it's a conversation I've never heard before, and I think that it's really...
Yeah, so basically what happened was, even though she wanted to live, her body was breaking down. She was in tremendous pain, and in her mind, she thought the pain was from the narcotics. She thought that they were causing stomach aches and constipation. The pain was from the cancer, and the cancer was taking over her body. And her normal hospice nurse was on vacation, who I dearly love. So I talked to another nurse over Labor Day weekend, and I said, I don't know what to do to help my mom let go. You know, I know she's fighting, and I know she's miserable, and she doesn't want to take the pain medication. And she explained that she felt if my mom started taking the pain medication regularly, it would allow her body to let go. And I said, so basically if I'm going to need to give orders against my mom's will to sort of force feed her this pain medication. And she said, well, yeah, you are, but it's the humane thing to do. And she said, when people are dying, a lot of times family members don't want to let go. And that patient keeps suffering so that the family can have one more day or one more conversation. And so I just said a quick prayer that I would have the right answer. And I had a caregiver and hospice nurse there at the same time. And we all talked and made the agreement that we were going to give her the medication against her will. And it wasn't that difficult. She didn't fight terribly. And I just explained to her over and over, Mom, this is going to relax you. It's going to make you feel better. And then that was on a Sunday, and Tuesday morning at 6 o'clock, the phone rang, and it was the caregiver. My mom called for me. I came over. I knew right then what was going on. And really, from the time I made that decision, I wondered, well, how long is it going to be? You know, how long is it going to take her to let go? She'd sort of lost consciousness the day before, but she popped up in bed. I came over. Her regular hospice nurse was back from vacation. I called her. She raced over. My mom's best friend, who was a tremendous support to me during that time, Renee, came over. I got my brother on the phone. He got to say goodbye to her. Once the hospice nurse was there, she started explaining to my mom, like, it's okay to let go. And my mom loved music, so I played The Fields of Gold for her. And there's a song called I Can Only Imagine that talks about where you're going in heaven. So we played that song and just encouraged her, you know, you're going to a great place, and it's okay to let go, and we all love you. And she was squeezing my hand, and I said, you know, can you understand what I'm saying? You know, are you still with us? And she would squeeze my hand, And I left. It was the most interesting thing. I left to run to the restroom, and the hospice nurse was a southern little thing. She said, Cam, get in here. And I said, what's going on? She said, well, your mom's dying. And I said, well, is she going to die today? Like, how long does, you know, what does this look like? And she said, no, she's dying right now. And so she said, she's going to die real quick, like within minutes. And
wow.
So she walked me through the whole process.
What is the process?
Like the first thing was that the circulation slows down, so the extremities get cold in your hands and feet. The breathing gets labored. You know, she shut her eyes. The strength she had in her hand, you know, to hold my hand gradually weakened. That's about all I can remember.
What was going through your head at that exact moment?
That I'm losing my mom.
And how did you feel about it?
I think at the moment, you know, I was somewhat concerned with the logistics because there's other things that happened from a medical standpoint that we kind of had to take care of during the process. You know, I think I remember thinking, gosh, I wish I wouldn't have given that medication. I wish I had one more day.
Did you feel guilty?
No, I didn't really feel guilty. I felt it was very mixed. I was at peace knowing I had done all that I could do. I was at peace knowing that her disease had gotten to the point where she had no quality of life left. And I was really at peace knowing that because of the way she lived her life and the person she was, that she was going to this fabulous place. And I think that's what brought me the most comfort, is to think of where she was going. And it was really interesting. She loved butterflies. And the day before she died, my younger brother lives in Durango, Colorado. And he said, oh, Cooper, my little nephew and I saw a black monarch butterfly. And I said, oh, my gosh, I saw a black monarch butterfly as well. So the day before she died, we both saw butterflies. And she had flowers out front. And tons of monarch butterflies always circling. And the day she died, there were more butterflies that came in her garden. And there were white butterflies, which I don't think I'd ever seen a white butterfly. So I feel like I looked at the flowers and I looked at the butterflies, and there was a lot of beauty in the world, and I knew she was going to a better place. And I felt like that was my sign of comfort. And that's when I began to let go. But I, in looking back, know now that I was in shock during that period of time. You know, my brother's out of town, so it was just me, so I made all the phone calls to friends and family, went right into planning the funeral. I was just over-functioning because there was no one else to do it, and I really didn't have time to go through and feel the emotions of the loss. I think I mentioned I didn't have a ton of time off work, so after the funeral, I started traveling. Then I interviewed for a job to move to California, which I love. Then I moved. And during that time, there were so many logistics to take care of. I was in charge of her estate, and that was not easy.
So it's almost like you were just checking the box, functioning.
Just going through the motions. And when people would ask me, how are you doing? You know, I'd say, well, it's hard, but, you know, I'm getting through it. But the truth is, I just wasn't able to even really get in touch with a lot of the things that I was feeling.
Do you feel like you were numb during that time?
Out of necessity, yes. Because had I not been numb, I don't think I could have continued functioning in my job, interviewing for another job, or moving across the country.
Compartmentalization?
Yep.
I want to talk about more about what the hospice nurse said to you, and just the I'd never heard of that conversation. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of that type of conversation with a hospice mm-hmm. nurse, and like I've had that, and I'll just relate it. Like I've had that about my dog mm-hmm. Riley when he was suffering a lot, and for 3 months it was like 3 months passed, and somebody had that conversation with me where they just said, you know, I mean. It was actually for his dignity because he couldn't even hold himself up anymore. He's an 85-pound dog, and he couldn't hold himself up to go to the bathroom. Like, I was helping him in all elements, and I realized I was holding on to him for me. Like, I didn't want to say goodbye, and it was a really hard decision. So I can't imagine have that about, like, my mom, like, or my dad or a family member and a nurse, like, saying that and thinking about, like, okay, like, it's one thing if they ask for the pain medication, but it's another thing, like, okay, this was going to relax them. And obviously it was just enough to relax them so they weren't in pain, exactly. But then it was going to allow her to mentally let go so that way she could move through the process in a graceful way, which is what she wanted.
Exactly.
But I can't imagine the burden and how you even got the courage to, okay.
Did you initiate that talk, or was it something the hospice nurse?
I think I did initiate it. I think that I said, you know, I know my mom well enough to know this is what I think is going on. And she had been prescribed Ativan, which is an anxiety medication as well as the narcotics. And I said, don't you think the Ativan would help calm her down? And she said, the combination, the Ativan and getting her out of pain. And she didn't say, like, she's going to die if you do this, but what I took away is this is the humane thing to do, is to give her that medication and let the process take place. And it's funny you mentioned that about the dog. A friend of mine I was talking to, I said, I feel like I'm putting my old dog down to rest. And that is what it felt like.
Do you regret that decision? This many months later?
You know, there have been moments where I thought, oh, I wish I would have used that last day to tell her one more thing. But overall, no. I'm just really big picture, and I try to look at the big picture that we had a lot more time than we had originally predicted. And I did the best I could, and my goal was to keep her comfortable. And so, of course, there's a part, you know, I mean, there's a part that sometimes I think, well, gosh, did I kill my mom? Like, just a fleeing thought. But that goes away real quick.
Did your mom give you any indication without actually saying the words that I would like medication? Because it seems like your mom was very strong.
She was a very strong German woman.
I don't expect her to have said it, but did she give you any things where you could read between the lines kind of thing?
That was actually the blessing, is that when I had that conversation, I sort of had visions in my mind of what's this going to look like? Is she going to be, you know, fighting, like literally putting up her hands, not wanting to take the medication? And she really didn't. So it was, I think God just sort of intervened. It was a lot less difficult than I thought it would be. She really didn't fight. Once we made that decision, she really didn't fight.
So there is, we do have a question on Twitter from Gigi, and she says, what she asked, was your mother in remission during those 3 years past the 8 months? And she said, I'm sincerely sorry for your loss.
Oh, thank you so much. That was my grandmother's name, Gigi.
Was it?
It was. No, she was not technically in remission. We gave her what they call a chemo holiday. After you're in chemotherapy long enough, the body starts to break down. Remarkably, she had got to the point, I think a normal tumor, what they call a TMF, tumor factor, I think she started off in the 2400s possibly, and a normal was a 40. Her oncologist was a genius in the medication regimen that he put her on, and she got down to a 40, where she was normal. that wasn't an remission. That was just due to the medication fighting that much cancer. Mm. We also had the talk at that point that if he were continued to give her chemotherapy, he would probably accelerate the dying process because the drugs were so toxic.
So it hurt her immune system?
Correct.
To the point where?
So we pulled her off chemo for, I think, about 9 months. And that was really during the time where we took the trips and traveled. And she felt great. Mm. I mean, well, all things considered.
Did the cancer spread everywhere?
It did.
So she was really sick. I mean, her body was failing.
Yeah, and every time I'd go to the doctor, the nurses would say, you know, do you realize how sick your mom is? Your mom is very, very sick. Because on the outside, she didn't look sick. I mean, she looked like she was having a ball, and she would make jokes with...
That must have been mentally hard, then, because if they don't... You can't see the insides, but on the outside, somebody looks...
And, you know, I think that was one of the hardest things for me is because she didn't look or act so sick, people continued to have expectations of her. You know, as a mother and as a friend, she was always there to support everyone else. And there were times where I really had to set some boundaries. You know, it's not a good day. She just doesn't have the energy. That was hard for her to say no, and it was hard for her to not play that role, but she didn't have the strength.
So you did.
I tried.
And then you probably had some enemies or had people upset.
Some hurt feelings.
Yeah.
So I want to say, so a year later, Kim is, she joins us for the board for the DJ Jackson Foundation, where we have our mission is about loss and grief. And she actually comes for our music therapy program for our kids ages 7 to 12, and she volunteers. And she ends up meeting one of the kids. And through the child sharing her story, Kim was able to share a story that she didn't realize that... Why don't you share it?
Sure. So that was really a pivotal moment. Like I mentioned earlier, I didn't have time to grieve. And when I went to the music therapy class, it was the day we wrote the words to What a Wonderful Life. And I connected with a little girl. Just hearing the music really brought everything to the surface for me, which was necessary.
Grief came to the surface
correct,
at that point.
Correct. And I think it was on multiple levels. The little girl that I was paired up with shared her story that her father had been in prison. He may have died in prison. Her brother had committed suicide, which I had a friend who died of suicide as well. And I just realized at that moment that all of my experiences, although her and I came from completely different backgrounds, I mean, for all practical purposes, I had a privileged upbringing. She's an inner city LA child. But based on my experiences, there's no doubt in my mind that to pair us up together was not an accident. Mm. Because I think the questions I was able to ask her and things that I shared about myself, there's no way she could have really related unless you can't relate. You can't really have true empathy for someone unless you've walked in their shoes. And I felt like in some regards I had walked in her shoes.
And so through what Kim had shared with me earlier is through sharing your story with this child in our music therapy program, she realized that I'm connecting to my own grief now. And Kim has since then started her own healing process of grieving for her mom and has now since gone into grief counseling as well as in you found a church in San Diego, and she's really working through her grief with her mom. And I think it was really amazing to hear and beautiful to hear that our music therapy program was
sort of brought that
to you.
Yep. I mean, it was a pivotal turning point.
And I think also just in terms of your faith, just reconnecting with your faith, which I think has helped you through your own grieving process.
Yeah, the hardest thing for me was that when I left St. Louis, I left my friends, my family, my church, everything that was secure. And then I got here and I was like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? But from that moment forward, I had previously kind of been in what they call the fog of grief. I was functioning at 50%. I couldn't remember things. Fortunate, I had an extremely supportive, wonderful friend who's a boss, and he really nurtured me through that time. But I wasn't functioning, and my friends and family kind of pointed it out to me. I mean, I had been trying to have fun, and I love music, so I was going to concerts.
You were running away in some sorts from grief.
I think so. And it just brought it to the surface, so I found another good counselor. Ironically, one of my friend's fathers founded an organization called Stephen Ministries, and I've been working with her, so
Is that these?
Yeah.
You want to talk about them real quick?
Basically, just through a friend of a friend, her father's authored several books on grief and loss, and they're short books, 20 pages long, and through reading those, it just kind of everything came full circle and was another pivotal point in my healing.
So I think one of the books is called Experiencing Grief by Kenneth Hawk, right? Mm-hmm. So where can you find these books?
I believe online through the Stevens Ministries website.
We'll have to send a link.
Yeah. So we'll put the link up. Yeah. So thank you, Kim, for sharing that, because maybe that could help someone else out there with their own grief.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it helped you, correct?
Absolutely.
Well, Kim, thank you so much for sharing your story. I know it's not easy to do, and I know you're nervous going in, but you're amazing.
Thank you.
And you've definitely helped others, so thank you so much.
Thank you.
Is there anything else you guys want to add?
You want to add?
No.
Thank you, Kim. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to The Power of Love. We are here to provide hope, resources, and a community so no one feels alone in their grief. Support for our Power of Love radio show comes from a variety of generous donors, including supporters from institutions, individuals, and corporations through the D.D. Jackson Foundation. DDJF is a nonprofit 501c3 organization.